Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind. Tonight we're talking about the 62nd Annual San Francisco International Film Festival. This year's festival boasts 163 documentary, independent, and short films, many of which are making their world premiere. The filmmakers behind them are driven by passion to explore and explain the world around them. They delve into critical issues, people, and trends that impact everything from immigration to inequality and entertainment to the environment through a filmmaking process that often takes years. Their ultimate goal? To tell a story that creates an opportunity for empathy and a point of connection for the audience. For the next 2 weeks, cinematic and live performances reflecting the social and cultural issues of our time will be found throughout San Francisco and the East Bay. But it's not all about the indie films. The festival will also honor some of Hollywood's stars for their activism in pursuit of social justice and their stand on streaming media. Joining us in the studio tonight to tell us about the festival and the journey of documentary filmmaking is Rachel Rosen, Director of Programming at SF Film, host of the San Francisco International Film Festival. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you for having me.
And also joining us in the studio is Tom Shepard, award-winning documentary filmmaker, San Francisco resident, and director and producer of Unsettled, Seeking Refuge in America, a film about the challenges facing LGBT refugees and asylum seekers, premiering at the film festival April 17th. Welcome, Tom.
Good to be here.
And also joining us in the studio is Amanda Mortimer, Bay Area journalist and director of production at The Representation Project. She produced The Great American Lie, a documentary taking a deep dive into the relationships between gender and wealth inequality and the American dream, directed by Jennifer Siebel Newsom, partner of California Governor Gavin Newsom, and premiering at the festival on April 15th. Welcome, Amanda.
Hi, thank you.
And, of course, we invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. We'll open the phone lines up in just about 20 minutes. The number to dial in is a toll-free line, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org or follow us on Twitter at cityvisionskalw. Well, Rachel, let me start with you. You've been the director of programming at SF Film now for 10 years. And what's different about the festival this year?
Well, the festival stays the same in its mission to show the broadest selection of what's great in film in any given year. This year, I'd say we're really expanding our screenings in the East Bay. So we're going to be at the Grand Lake for an extended run. We've had a long partnership with the BAM PFA. But in terms of the content, I would say it's the usual exciting mix of documentaries, narratives, short films that you described in your opening. Yeah.
And have you noticed any change in the themes this year or any kind of general trends that might set this year apart from others?
Yeah, it's really fun to watch the trends emerge as we're programming. I'll say like one of the trends I noticed, especially in the nonfiction films, was that there's something of a more positive look at activism. I think for the past 2 years, we've seen some inappropriately anxious and hand-wringing sort of explorations of things going on in the world. And there are definitely filmmakers who are still tackling difficult topics, but there's a whole wave of films about activism that really left us with a positive feeling. You know, maybe it's just we really responded to those films because as programmers, that's what we felt like we needed. But that could run the gamut from everything to a wonderful documentary we're showing called We Are the Radical Monarchs, which is it's a free screening open to the public at the Castro's Theater. And it's about a troop, you know, sort of a Girl Scout-like troop, but instead of getting badges for sewing or cooking, they get badges for activism and gender studies. That Knock Down the House, which, you know, follows four women who are challenging challenging men in the primaries. And, you know, one of them just happens to be Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. So just to be able to watch something with like a triumphant sort of bring tears to your eyes victory is really enlightening. But even something like a documentary about Dr. Ruth, which to me, I consider her to be an early activist. She is an activist about sex positivity. You know, a wonderful documentary looking at her life. So I would say that's definitely one of the themes.
Right. So a lot to look forward to for those who are attending. And maybe for those who are unfamiliar with the festival, can you describe a bit about the history and also how people can be engaged in this year's festival, how they can find out what's going on and know where to be, you know, to see things that match their interests?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll give you as much of a thumbnail as I can for a festival that's 62 years old. So the San Francisco International Film Festival is the oldest film festival in the Americas. It was started in 1957 by a wonderful local exhibitor named Bud Levin. It was at a time when San Francisco was sort of at the center of international culture with the UN starting. There was an Italian film festival, and he got interested in distributing international films here and thought it would be a good idea to start a festival. I mean, at the time, there was just a small handful of festivals in the world. And when it first started, it was very much an international film festival like it is now. There was a competition for emerging filmmakers, which if you look at the films in the competition, they're like the greats of international cinema, like Satyajit Ray and Andrzej Wajda had films as new directors in this competition. For a while, it was a sort of Hollywood stop. People would fly up from L.A. You know, Betty Davis was a guest at the festival. And then it became more of the community event that it is now, probably in the late 60s, early 70s. And now, of course, it is much more, you know, you don't have to wear your elbow-length gloves or your black tie and tails to come see a movie. It is a community event. We want it to be available to everyone. I think a lot of people think like, you know, I don't know if I can attend a film festival. And, you know, you can absolutely get individual tickets. It is open to everyone. It can be a little daunting because, as you say, there are 163 programs, but there are a lot of ways to find, and they're all very different. I mean, it's everything, as you said, from visiting tributes to visiting celebrities like John C. Reilly and Laura Dern to avant-garde shorts programs and everything in between. But if you just go fishing around on the website, sffilm.org, you could probably find something that you would want to see.
All right, good. Well, hopefully people will take you up on that and look into what some of the programming is. And you mentioned some of these actors. Who is being honored at this film festival? I mean, obviously Betty Davis has passed on, but maybe, you know, there are actors following in her footsteps up here, up I-5 or taking a Southwest flight or maybe something more glamorous. So you can describe some of the Hollywood names that listeners would probably recognize.
Yeah, absolutely. The festival also, at a certain point, pioneered the idea of a tribute. It was actually the first festival. I mean, they used to be day-long tributes, which is maybe a little bit too much for our fast-paced world. But we're continuing in that tradition. So we have tributes to three great actors. Laura Linney, who also appears in our opening night presentation, Armistead Maupin's Tales of the City. We're doing a dedicated tribute to her. The wonderful actor John C. Reilly is going to be here. We're doing a tribute to his work, and we're showing a film that he starred in but was also very involved in the production of called The Sisters Brothers, which is really an underappreciated film from this year. So this is a chance to see it in person with him at the Castro. And then the fantastic Laura Dern. I mean, she has been an actor since she was very young, but she's really had a renaissance in the past few years. She has a a feature film coming out. She has Big Little Lies. And then she has the film that we're showing, which is a really, really great social issue narrative film called Trial by Fire, which is based on a New Yorker article by David Gran.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, for those not following these socially conscious films, she was also in the latest Star Wars, too. So she was out there with Princess Leia, for those who aren't.
That might feature in the Clips program.
All right. So stay tuned for those attending the Laura Dern piece of the festival. Well, so we mentioned that there are 163 films, but you had to whittle that down. Can you describe how this process of how someone who has a film, and we're going to talk to two other filmmakers in just a second, but how you get that number down? How does this work? How do these filmmakers get their products into the their films into the festival?
Yeah, so there are four or five of us who work year-round looking for films to show. And there are sort of two ways that we do it. And one is we have an open call for entries. And that usually brings in somewhere between 2,500 and 3,000 films, the majority of which are shorts. And we have a team of people that we work with regularly who just start screening and sorting through them. And we ask them to recommend things for us to watch. And so while that's happening, we're also acting as sort of detectives and looking at what's out in the world. And we do that a lot of different ways. We have 62 years of filmmakers whose work we've shown. So we'll talk to filmmakers that we've worked with or producers. A lot of countries have national agencies that help promote films or sales agents, but we'll also do things like look at Kickstarter and see what kind of films are in production. SF Film, which is the organization that puts on the festival, also has a very robust grants program. So we also now become aware of films as they're in production through our artist development program. So we'll stay in very close touch with those filmmakers about what's happening with their films. And we're really happy that we're featuring a bunch of those films in this year's program, many of which premiered at Sundance, which is very exciting for us, and are now having their San Francisco premieres. And then we'll take sort of what's rising from those. We watch a lot of movies, as you can guess, and we meet once a week to talk about them. And we sort of pass them around and talk about them because each film has to work on its own merits, but we're also putting together a program for the Bay Area primarily. I mean, we get visitors from out of state and out of the country, but we're really a festival for San Francisco audiences. So we want to show films that we think reflect the interests and values of the Bay Area, which are very broad. And then we also, you know, you want the festival to have a certain kind of balance. You don't want all the films to be about one topic, or, you know, everything to be from one country, even if we often do find, as we said before, that themes arise. So we have a spotlight on food and film because there are so many good movies about food and film. We didn't want to say like, oh, well, we can't show this one because we're showing this other one. But sort of looking for balance on the whole.
And probably grouping them by theme is helpful for audiences who have something they can sort of, no pun intended, but sink their teeth into if they're looking for a particular type of programming, I would imagine.
Exactly.
Well, let's talk to I'm going to start with one filmmaker who's has a film, and this is Tom Shepard, director of the movie Unsettled, documentary. And Tom, just a little bit of background about you. So when did you move to San Francisco, and what brought you here?
Yeah, I moved here in the mid-90s, had been working in public radio, actually in D.C. at NPR. I was a human biology major in college, so I took kind of a right turn and kind of learned by doing. My first film, Scouts Honor, was about the issue of gays in the Boy Scouts that was happening in the 90s, and the people that I worked with on that film were, you know, really, really great mentors. They were talented production folks, but they also had great mentoring instincts, and so produced that film and then have basically stayed here in the Bay Area since then. So.
And I'm sure you don't want to toot your own horn, but Scouts Honor won the Sundance Film Festival Audience Award for Best Documentary, and the Freedom of Expression Award, so we should let listeners know about that achievement. And in terms of this latest documentary, Unsettled, Seeking Refuge in America, which will be debuting next week, premiering next week, what exactly inspired you to take on that subject?
So I would say 5 or 6 years ago, as a gay man myself, was just aware of kind of the accelerated, you know, kind of civil rights for LGBT people. It's right kind of in light of the marriage equality that was going on, and kind of at the same time, the sort of atrocities that were happening in other places in the world, particularly the Middle East and Africa. So this kind of dissonance, and I would say a little complacency within my own community about some of the migration, immigration, refugee issues. So I started doing some volunteer work at the Jewish Family and Community Services of the East Bay. And for decades, they've been doing refugee resettlement work. But they got a pretty significant grant from the United Nations and from their parent group, HIAS, the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, to resettle LGBT refugees that were starting to arrive in San Francisco. And I thought, okay, this is a pretty ripe moment to explore this issue and maybe, you know, create a movie that might be an occasion for dialogue between some of the immigration communities and the LGBT community.
And when was this that you were volunteering, that you started to get into this topic?
2014, 2015. So yeah, it's been a 5-year journey to
and
get the film.
And the topic, it seems like it just has become more and more pressing. I mean, not only, I mean, the LGBT discrimination obviously is kind of constant in some to some degree, but the issue of immigration and refugees, has that sort of helped bolster attention for your subject here, the fact that now that's really in the news a lot about refugees coming to the United States in general?
Yeah, I mean, I would think most of the people in our film and in the communities expected that Hillary Clinton was going to be the next president and kind of carry the banner of Barack Obama as related to refugees and immigration. And in fact, President Obama had raised the number of immigrants allowed into the U.S. yearly to what it had been previously. So as I was talking before the show, our ability to even get the film funded went, you know, way up after President Trump won that election. So, yeah, and the fact that he ran on a, you know, kind of anti-immigration platform, anti-refugee platform, and, you know, pretty much is maligning refugees on a daily basis, I think maybe points to the need to have a film like this that sort of humanizes the experiences and the lives of refugees. Because I think most Americans actually don't know this story. I mean, they sort of get fed a lot of news about refugees and Syrian refugees, but actually have not met one. And so I think, you know, that's what we're hoping to do with the film as we launch here at the film festival, is really kind of introduce a larger, you know, section of the American public to who refugees are.
And can you describe just a bit about the film, how you structured it, and what people can expect when they go in to see it?
Yeah, so there are three stories primarily. There's a story of a gay Syrian man, Subi, who fled just as the war in Syria was escalating in 2012, 2013, and he fled to Beirut and ultimately to Turkey, and then received his refugee status to be resettled in the U.S. And we met him before he moved to the States via Skype through his refugee host. And then there's a story of a lesbian couple from Angola. I was meeting and working with a woman who lives up in Marin County who started an organization who works with folks in Africa, primarily LGBT refugees and asylum seekers. And she wrote to me and said there's this couple who is, I mean, it's very rare for women in particular to be able to flee many of these countries. They're expected to get permission from their fathers or their husbands. So the fact that this couple had been able to form their relationship and then flee Angola and make it to the United States was pretty miraculous. And we were able to meet them within days of their arrival. And so we followed their story for about 3 years. And then the story of Junior, who is a gender nonconforming gay man from the Congo, who had had a really rough time, a fundamentalist family that he grew up in, and had fled to Cape Town. Many of the refugees will flee to a country of transit before they ultimately get resettled. And we were able to follow him as well for a good period.
So it sounds like pretty fortuitous timing that you were able to be there on site when a lot of these events were actually happening. I guess that's one of the advantages of working on something for 5 years.
I think so. You know, and I think there's this, you know, Rachel was talking a little bit about, you know, the character of San Francisco. And I think particularly within in the LGBT community, you know, the city is still seen as a kind of emerald city and a mecca for LGBT people to come. I came from Colorado Springs, a very conservative place, because it was very difficult to be gay there. So, but then folks get here, you know, in the year 2015 or 2016 and, you know, try living on a refugee benefit of $335 a month. And in some ways what we found is that some of the sexual orientation and gender identity issues took a backseat to the real just issues of survival in modern day San Francisco.
All right. Well, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco. We're also streaming live on the web at KALW.org. Tonight we're talking about the San Francisco International Film Festival with the festival's hosts and Bay Area filmmakers. We're joined by Rachel Rosen, Director of Programming at SF Film, host of the San Francisco International Film Festival. Also joined by Tom Shepard, who you just heard, award-winning documentary filmmaker and director of producer of Unsettled, Seeking Refuge in America, a film about the challenges facing LGBT refugees and asylum seekers premiering at the film festival on April 17th. And we're also joined by Amanda Mortimer, Bay Area journalist and director of production at the Representation Project. She produced The Great American Lie, a documentary taking a deep dive into the relationships between gender and wealth inequality in the American dream, directed by Jennifer Siebel Newsom, partner of California Governor Gavin Newsom, and premiering on April 15th. And we want to open the phone lines to your questions and comments. Have you bought your tickets yet for the festival? If so, what events do you plan to attend? Have you seen a film that's challenged your perceptions or caused you to change your opinion? And what issues would you like to see filmmakers dive into? Please bring us your questions or comments. The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. You can post a comment on kalw.org or follow us and send us your questions on Twitter at cityvisionskalw. Well, Tom, just staying with you for just a couple more minutes here, we do have a clip from Unsettled. And this is a clip with two of the refugees, partners Mary and Cheyenne from Angola, who have been persecuted for their sexuality. And this is as they're preparing to come to the U.S. So why don't we hear a clip from Unsettled.
We thought at least here we're not going to have like people stalking us or following us or throwing rocks or say like calling us name on the street. And I think this don't happen here in America, right?
I'm scared because I feel responsible for her. But then she said, you know, I feel the same way about you. If you end up on the street, I'll end up too. It's fine. At least we don't.
We're a team, of course.
At least we don't get to be so much persecuted the way we have been now. Yeah, we are a team.
So, Tom, obviously very personal stories there. Just your reaction to Mary and Cheyenne's story. I mean, how did it change you following these two along in their journey to come to the U.S.?
I mean, it's interesting as a filmmaker working with folks who have experienced a lot of trauma, and I would say most of these folks were the age, you know, they were in their mid-20s when they came here. So I'm about the age of their parents, and most of them dealt with persecution not only from the larger society, but kind of at the hands of their own families and their parents. So I think this project in particular, kind of developing the trust necessary to, you know, be able to do a kind of intimate storytelling was pretty challenging. And so I think having 3, 4, 5 years to sink into the story, to spend time before, you know, we necessarily bring our cameras in all the time, just develop a relationship where they can say, okay, this guy's not trying to do a hit piece on us. Because not only are they dealing with all the issues of acculturation and trying to find a place to live, but their status actually wasn't in place for a couple, 3 years. They were asylum seekers, and they had to go through an adjudication process. So, you know, every day felt pretty precarious for them. So it's kind of a testament to them, given how much they'd had to sort of be very quiet about their sexuality and about their relationship, that they were willing to sort of turn fairly quickly and start to share that very publicly. So it was such a privilege to be able to work with them.
Well, and I was struck by one comment. I saw an advance screener of the documentary. It hasn't premiered yet, but the refugee from Syria who is going to speak before the United Nations and essentially tell the world about his sexuality, which is potentially punishable by death in his home country. So I would imagine that your subjects had a lot of bravery just to even agree to be filmed in the way that they were for your documentary.
Yeah, that's Subi, who you're referring to, that was a very unusual story that within, I think, maybe 3 months of being in the U.S., he was invited by then-Ambassador Samantha Power to come testify before the Security Council. It was the first time that a gay person had testified at the U.N. in that way. That was an enormous step for someone, again, who, you know, had, you know, who's strategy in life to survive had been to kind of hide. So, yeah.
Talk about literally coming out to the world.
Yeah.
That's how
yeah.
you do it. All right. Well, Amanda Mortimer, I want to go to you. You're the producer of The Great American Lie that we talked about in the opening and just now at the break. And it's the last film in a trilogy about gender in America. And the first was Misrepresentation, a Sundance Grand Jury Prize nominee. And then you followed that with The Mask You Live In, which won the Women Film Critics Circle Award. So I want to plug those honors. I know people don't want to brag, but we'll happy to brag for you. So I just want to ask you a similar question that I asked Tom. First of all, what is The Great American Lie about for our listeners, and what inspired you to make this piece of the trilogy?
Great. Thank you so much for having us. The Great American Lie is a film that examines how a U.S. value system based on the hyper-masculine ideals of power, money, and control has glorified individualism, institutionalized inequality, and undermined the ability of most Americans to achieve the American dream. It's a big idea film. And as you mentioned, I made this film with Jennifer Siebel Newsom, who's the director and producer and writer of this film. And Jennifer and I and our film team really view this film as the third, as you said, in a trilogy that explores how our society is affected by harmful gender stereotypes and norms. And so, you know, each film kind of builds on the next, and gender is a very strong through line. Misrepresentation really looked at the media's limited an overly sexual representation of women and how that leads to the underrepresentation of girls and women in positions of power and leadership. The Mask You Live In was sort of born out of that. Jennifer wanted to look at the other side of the coin and examine America's narrow definition of masculinity and how that really harms boys and men. And it was in the course of making The Mask You Live In many years ago now that she really realized that there was an opportunity to expand the conversation and to look further at how these harmful gender stereotypes and norms are really impacting society at large.
And so was the intention to do a trilogy or to just kind of organically morph into that as you work through this topic?
Well, Jennifer's been making these films longer than I have, but I do think that this was an organic experience that, you know, she's making one film that felt really, that spoke to her life at that time, beginning a family, she had a daughter, it changed her perspective of the world, then she had a son, it changed her perspective of the world again, and I can relate because Jennifer has 4 young kids and I have 3 young kids, so between us, you know, we're running a busy business of childcare and filmmaking. But, I think it's natural that the films that you make reflect, like, what's going on in your life and the issues that are pertinent. And clearly, you know, in the last several years, I think, you know, we've all started to really pay a great deal of attention to the state of economic and social inequality in America. We are in a period of extreme economic inequality. We know right now that 0.1% of the population has as much wealth as the bottom 90%. You know, this is as extreme as, you know, the inequality was right before the Great Depression in the late 1920s. The statistics are pretty staggering. Nearly half of American households today are liquid asset poor, meaning that they have less than 3 months' worth of savings, which is estimated to be about $5,800. So, you know, income and wealth are, you know, there's a huge chasm and a very small number of people, have consolidated an enormous amount of wealth. But what we really want to do with that information is say, how did we get here? And in particular, we want people to consider how our values really contributed to creating the economic and social inequality that we have today. So that's kind of the unique perspective that we're bringing to this film. For example, you know, the film posits that we value professions and institutions and people in this country that we associate with the hyper-masculine stereotypical ideas of power, money, and control. And then we pay those people more and we funnel more resources to them, weapons, wars, prisons. And meanwhile, we undervalue things that we associate with stereotypically feminine ideals of care, collaboration, partnership. And we tend to pay certain professions less, teachers. We funnel fewer resources to certain institutions, education, care. And so the question is, how do these gender stereotypes and norms influence our values, and how do they play a role in elevating some and diminishing others and entire groups of people? And what happens when we really look at our values? Can we make a difference?
So touching on major issues, not just of gender, but obviously income inequality, also very much in the news, as is gender, with things like the Me Too movement. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco. It's streaming live on the web at KALW.org. Tonight we're talking about the San Francisco International Film Festival with the festival's host and Bay Area filmmakers. We're joined by Rachel Rosen, Director of Programming at SF Film, host of the International Film Festival. Also Tom Shepard, award-winning documentary filmmaker and director and producer of Unsettled, Seeking Refuge in America. And also joined by Amanda Mortimer, Bay Area journalist and director of production at the Representation Project. And she produced The Great American Lie, directed by Jennifer Siebel Newsom. We invite you, our listeners, to join this conversation. The number to dial is a toll-free line, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. You can also follow us or send us questions on Twitter at City Visions KALW. We want to hear from you. If you're planning to go to the festival, if you've attended in the past and have memories you want to share, if you have certain topics that you would like to see filmmakers cover, we want to hear from you on that. So that's 1-866-798-TALK to join us. So, Amanda, I wanted to go back to you on your film, The Great American Lie, and just if you can describe for listeners, how is the story structured? What can they expect if they end up going to this movie?
Sure. So this film has a similar sort of structure to Jennifer Siebel Newsom's first two films, Misrepresentation and The Mask You Live In, in that there are a series of narrative stories following real people that are grounded by interviews with experts in a variety of fields, economics, history, sociology, gender, et cetera. And what's I think we're excited about with this film is that we've been able to spend a lot more time with the five key subjects and really be with these people longer and tell deeper stories and really build out that the storytelling aspect of the film more. So we're really excited about that.
Well, we have a clip that we'd like to play from the film, and it is a setup here. So this is Oakland principal Ruby Detai, so a local resident and a local story featured in the story. And she's discussing how far removed her students are from even being able to think about the American dream. So let's hear this clip from The Great American Lie.
Nothing is wrong with my kids. Everything is wrong with the system. We're a society of do-it-yourself. Like, that's the American dream, is pull yourself up by your bootstraps. When you don't have boots, it's hard. We serve a very high population of students who are in foster care, a lot of homeless families. My students come with no supplies, no backpack, didn't eat. They come with, dad is in jail. My father was taken from our family and deported last night. The list goes on and on of what they bring. And if they have a bad day and they roll their eyes, then now you take it personally as an adult. But you don't even know that her mom is on a crack bench right now. And she probably rolled her eyes because she didn't want to take her sweater off because her uniform shirt is dirty. But you didn't ask her. You assumed. That's inequity.
So this is a very powerful story that you featured in this documentary, and it's a local story, so I think a lot of residents here in the Bay Area can definitely relate to it. So in this film, it's the principal, Ruby Detai, and she welcomes Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf at one point for a visit to her school, and there's a really striking scene of the mayor just clearly shocked when she hears about some of the trauma that these kids experience, high rates of self-harm, even attempted suicide, some very powerful scenes of students talking about particularly immigrant students, talking about the fear they feel with the election of Donald Trump, how it's affecting their families. And so there's a lot there that's really powerful and concerning, I think, for people who watch the film. And so what message do you give to the audience members about what can be done to change the situation? I mean, it just feels so difficult, and people, I think, can feel pretty powerless about what to do to help in this situation. But what's the sort of message that you would like to leave for the audience members?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things about the American dream that the film addresses is that the dream tells us that, you know, if you work hard, you can make it, you can get ahead. And it's about individualism. It's about hard work and this idea that your circumstances don't matter. But we all know that circumstances are hugely impactful. Circumstances matter, and people need the support of their communities. And so when we meet children at, you know, the Frick Impact Academy in East Oakland, you meet a community of students that are really challenged. And as you said, about 30% of the students at Ruby's school are newcomers to America. And so they are bringing an enormous amount of trauma with them. And, you know, even all the students who have grown up in Oakland their whole lives. And so I think that what we want people to do is to watch these stories and to see other human beings and to recognize that we all have to care about one another more, that we have to reach out and start, you know, making connections to find the common humanity and stop focusing as much on our differences, which are just, you know, put front and center all the time in media and news, and really start to focus on where we are similar. I think Jennifer and I were really impacted by being at the school over and over again with children at home, and then seeing children, you know, middle schoolers, you know, bringing with them so much every day, and you know, that it's hard for them to get into that classroom and focus if they haven't had a good breakfast, if they're dealing with, you know, all sorts of other layers of complexity and trauma at home. And so as moms, as filmmakers, as women, as, you know, we think that it's important to tell those stories and to shine a light on what's going on there. So hopefully we can build some empathy and build some compassion for the plight of these kids and turn it into, you know, policy change eventually. Like, people get involved, they start caring. One of the things about inequality is that it has a tendency to separate people physically. There are, you know, entire communities of people that don't see other people, people who are not like them. That is a sort of a side effect of increasing economic inequality. And so what we have to do is make an effort to see other people. You can't put yourself in someone else's shoes if you don't even see them. So I think one of the, you know, great aspects of, you know, documentary filmmaking in particular is that it allows us, just like Tom is doing in his documentary, to tell stories and connect people with people they might not see, they might not understand, and then hopefully allow them an opportunity to really see somebody who's at a different experience, having a completely different experience in life, and start to recognize where they share, you know, what they share in common.
And obviously the empathy is critical, as you say, it's foundational to any sort of change, and the documentaries, I think, are really well suited for that. I have to ask, just how did you get involved in this particular film? What's the history there?
You know, as it turns out, I actually am one of the many young women. I can't call myself a young woman anymore. I'm one of the many women who watched Misrepresentation many years ago and was very moved and inspired by it. And my personal professional background is in news, and I had worked at a news network for a long time. And I saw Misrepresentation, and I thought, gosh, that is awesome. I really want to do that. You know, it's just incredible storytelling on important issues, and, you know, content matters. Good storytelling matters. And so, you know, I was able to make a connection with Jennifer, and, you know, we've been working now on The Great American Lie for more than 5 years, and, you know, it's been a great partnership, and, you know, it's been a great experience to work with her. She's a very passionate, you know, person.
And both you and Tom spent 5 years on your documentaries. Did things change for you with the election of Trump as it did with Tom's film, Unsettled?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, you have to be responsive to what's going on. you know, to keep the films relevant. And you know, I think Jennifer and I thought the film would be ready sooner. And the election happened, and I do think that it surprised, you know, it surprised a lot of people, right? And it certainly surprised us. And I think that it made it really important. We're making a film about our values and the intersection of gender and values. And you know, we just had the election of, you know, President Donald Trump, and what did he symbolize? And so, you know, his rhetoric, his demeanor, you know, this idea that in America we are revering things that are hypermasculine in nature: power, money, control, dominance. Well, look what just happened. So I think it was an important moment to say, okay, let's take a look at what this is about and how it's part of the story. And we actually, you know, we made a point of pursuing a couple, you know, new storylines, and we spent time with a steelworker in Ohio who, you know, really is this incredibly empathetic character who experienced, you know, economic hardship, losing his job as a steelworker at a point in time when he had three young children and he had to, you know, look for other work and create his own gutter cleaning business. And I think what happens is you look for these stories that, you know, flesh out and you know, make the mm-hmm. film resonant and relevant and timely
and current. That story is very emblematic, I think, of the 2016 elections in a lot of ways. So this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco. We're also streaming live on the web at KALW.org. Tonight we're talking about the San Francisco International Film Festival with the festival's host and Bay Area filmmakers. We're joined by Rachel Rosen, director of programming at SF Film, host of the festival. Also joined by Tom Shepard, director and producer of Unsettled, Seeking Refuge in America, a film that will be premiering on April 17th, and Amanda Mortimer, producer of The Great American Lie, directed by Jennifer Siebel Newsom, which is premiering on April 15th. We invite you, our listeners, to call to join the conversation, and you can do that by dialing our toll-free line, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org or follow us on Twitter at cityvisionskalw. We have an email in from Art in San Francisco who asks, what are some of the comedies, shorts, and political documentaries that will be playing in the festival this year? So, Rachel Rosen, let me direct that question to you. What can audience members expect on that front?
Sure. So many. I'll take them in order. Comedies, I would say one of the big comedies, maybe a breakthrough comedy, is a movie by Olivia Wilde called Booksmart. It is a story of two young women in high school who have done everything right to get into good colleges. And it's the last day of school, and they figure out all their classmates have been not working as hard as they have and also got into good colleges. And so they have one night to make up for their good behavior with a little living large. And it's really lovely and delightful. And we also have a great centerpiece, which is not strictly a comedy. It's a comedy drama. It's called The Farewell. It's by Lulu Wang. And it stars Awkwafina. And I think, you know, she is, of course, delightful and funny, but also I think shows some real dramatic chops in this story. And it's a story of a family, and the grandmother has a fatal illness, but the tradition is that you don't tell the grandmother that she's dying, so they have to sort of concoct this reason for everyone to go visit. So they kind of make up a fake wedding, and the whole family goes to stay with the grandmother. Shorts, we have 8 different shorts programs, so you can really find something for everyone. I would say, you know, our family films shorts are one of our most popular programs. It's a really great thing to come to with your whole family and with kids. Mm-hmm. We also have a wonderful animation program that's very popular. And then we like to, unlike some other festivals, we like to mix up our documentaries and fiction shorts together. So that's, there are 8 shorts programs to choose from. and then political documentaries. That was the other question, right? Mm-hmm. And I would define that in its broadest way. For example, like as I was talking about, you could see Knock Down the House. We also have a film that we're showing on April 20th, 420, called Grass is Greener. And it's directed by Fred Brathwaite. You might know him better as Fab Five Freddy, the former host of Yo! MTV Raps. And it's a movie about cannabis, but specifically about the way laws against the legalization of marijuana were really directed at African Americans and Mexican Americans. And it sort of traces the history of cannabis coming to the U.S. and its interaction with music and the way that people have tried to suppress it as a way of suppressing expression of African Americans and Mexican Americans, which, I mean, the way politics plays out in documentaries is everything from, you know, talking in terms of like big ideas like the Great American Lie, or as subtle as an environmental documentary like The Elephant Queen, which is, again, it's another family film. So it's a film that follows in the great tradition of nature documentaries, a herd of elephants that has to move because of drought. But there's a very explicit but not explicitly stated environmental theme as part of that documentary. And what I love about the films at the festival is the ways the filmmakers are using all the elements of the medium to tell these stories. And sometimes it's very visual and very visceral. Sometimes it's very heady and often very heartfelt. And usually it's a combination of all those things. So I think there's a lot of political films that people wouldn't assume are political.
So lots of variety there, and not very comprehensive content. So, Art, thank you for that email question. Let's go to the phone lines. We have Carolyn from San Anselmo. Carolyn, welcome to City Visions.
Hi, thank you. I have a question for the producer of the Great American Lie. I'm wondering, so you're a female filmmaker making a film with another female filmmaker, and there are very few women in this industry. I'm wondering if you could talk a bit about why the industry is not more inclusive of women, and what advice you would give to maybe young girls or women who want to go into filmmaking.
All right. Thank you, Carolyn, for that question. So, Amanda Mortimer, maybe this is the subject of your fourth film in the series of on looking at gender. How does that? What is your response in terms of making documentary filmmaking more accessible and open to female storytellers?
I mean, well, this certainly doesn't just have to do with filmmaking, right? I mean, the entire premise of misrepresentation is, you know, how our media is limited representation of women on screen leads to their underrepresentation in positions of power and leadership in all industries. So women are represented in small numbers in a lot of industries. You know, that will change. It is changing. Certainly look at what happened in the most recent midterm election. You know, there is progress. And, you know, I certainly would, it is a wonderful thing to be able to do what you love. And so, you know, just as you know, a mom with young girls, I want to model for them the things that I think are important, and standing up for what I think is right, and giving a voice to people who don't have a voice, telling important stories. I think all of those are important things. And so I would certainly encourage any young woman who's interested in getting involved in any field, whatever it is, to stay at it and not back down. I mean, you're going to come across all sorts of challenges, but certainly to stay with it. You know, our organization, we're fortunate. Jennifer Siebel Newsom founded the Representation Project, which is a nonprofit organization, after the premiere of Misrepresentation, her first documentary. And the organization, you know, envisions a world free of gender stereotypes and norms. And so we have a lot of programming, and part of it is the films and educational curricula and community screenings, and then working directly with youth is one of those things. So we are actually working directly with youth, in particular young women, to help them find a voice, to help them identify negative narratives in their community where they see them, and then to develop the skills to address those and to tell their stories. And so, you know, I think it's always important to encourage girls to use their voices wherever they can, and boys too. You know, I mean, it's important across the board.
All right. Well, thank you, Carolyn, for that question. We have an email question from Glenn in Marin County, who asks if the filmmakers here could comment on the economics of documentary filmmaking. So, Tom Shepard, let me start that question for with you. You mentioned you got more funding once Trump got elected, but can you comment more generally about how you put these films together from a financial standpoint?
Yeah, I mean, I was just thinking when I got into filmmaking like 20 years ago, I think documentary was a little more educational with a capital E. You know, it was like good for you. And I feel like in the last particularly 10 years that the genre has really captured the American attention in a much, much bigger way. And obviously we see, you know, Amazon and Netflix and a number of other folks wanting to get in that space. But speaking for myself, I don't feel like the economic models have changed that much. I've worked primarily in public television and have worked with the Independent Television Service, which has been great in terms of supporting work at the front end and then really supporting the engagement and outreach and distribution of the films. But the budgets actually haven't gotten a lot bigger over the years. So I find most of my colleagues really struggle to get these films made, and particularly in the first period, in the R&D period, in the early pre-production and production, when you kind of need that support more than any other time. So, you know, it's one reason why I really love the Bay Area, is that there's just, a critical mass of documentary filmmakers. And unlike maybe the Hollywood system, there's a real sense of, I think, camaraderie and sharing resources and working together and sort of understanding that it's difficult. But I think there's a sort of shared passion, as Amanda was saying, as Rachel was saying, you know, for seeing these stories told and then amplified. So I continue to be awed by just, you know, how folks can, you know, can kind of get these projects done on pure passion. So
is it fair to say that the revenue doesn't really cover the cost, that there has to be foundation support or other types of support, or can filmmakers expect to actually recoup their costs through ticket sales or licensing to different media outlets?
I think it's rare that filmmakers will, you know, make a lot of net profit, although I'm a member of a group called New Day Films, which is a kind of a cooperative of 100 social issue filmmakers, and we work together to distribute the work to universities. So one market that's actually fairly lucrative is, you know, university classrooms. So professors and acquisitions people and librarians really want to program a lot of this work in the university, and they still have resources to be able to buy the film. But yeah, there's, I think people rely on small arts organizations. In San Francisco, we got a grant from Horizons Foundation, also the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation. There are a number of folks who can provide some of that some of that early money. So,
well, and you mentioned some of the streaming services like Netflix and Amazon and Hulu that are acquiring films. Does that change the landscape at all for documentary filmmakers? You mentioned the budget doesn't change, but it seems like there's more content now, more ways for content to get out there and reach people.
Certainly in terms of impact and in terms of audience, I think we're seeing crossover to a much broader, American audience. In terms of funding, I think increasingly you're seeing some of those entities getting involved early on. But, you know, traditionally they've acquired work at the end and don't always, pay filmmakers for their work. So we'll see how that goes. Yeah.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about the educational aspect of this, and specifically working with youth. And Rachel, let me start with you. I know film education is a big part of SF Film. So how many students do you work with every year, and how do you expose them to the craft and science of filmmaking?
Gosh, we work with thousands and thousands of students every year. I think we're expecting close to 8,000 students at the festival this year. So we've had one of the longest running schools at the festival programs in the U.S. And it started just as a program where we would basically bring classes to the festival to see films there. And under the Keith Zwolfer is the name of the person who runs the program. It's really expanded. It's a year-round program. We still bring thousands of students to the festival to see films, but we'll also take filmmakers into individual classrooms if students can't come. We work year round on screenings. We have a summer camp where, kids want to learn how to make films, we can teach them. And we have a youth, program in the festival where we screen films by people, in high school or younger. And for example, we screened a film by a young gentleman several years ago. In that youth program. And he went on to make a film that was quite popular at Sundance this year called Last Black Man in San Francisco.
Right,
so we've really seen like talent coming through.
You're seeing success. You're seeing the fruits of your labor.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely.
That's a great success story. So, Amanda, I wanted to ask you as well about how the Representation Project is working specifically with youth. But I have to say we just got an email question in for you from Rick in San Francisco. So I want to let you take the stab at this one first. And Rick says, I heard California has some of the worst economic inequality in the country with a relatively progressive electorate. What can California do to reduce inequality? And of course, the director of your film is married to the governor of California, so I'm sure this is something that you've probably talked about. But any kind of take-home points that you can briefly describe?
I mean, tackling inequality. I mean, the film posits that part of the reason that we have such extreme inequality in America today is cultural. It's based on our values. So part of our answer from the film's perspective is that if the problem is cultural, then the solution is cultural too. We have an opportunity to evaluate, examine our values, and make changes. What is important to us? What, you know? And in the film, actually, Governor Newsom is interviewed in the film, and he talks about how a budget is essentially a set of values. And so, you know, you can tell what our priorities are based on where we put our money. And so are we putting it towards education or are we putting it towards prisons? And, you know, I know that, you know, the film doesn't take on a lot of specific policy suggestions, but each of the stories actually does kind of thread out some ideas related to education and incarceration and economic justice.
And real quick on how Representation Project works with children, any
yeah, so one of our tenants is working directly with youth. We have annually a youth leadership summit where we bring together youth from around generally, you know, parts of California. And, you know, we work with them to help them identify limiting narratives in their community and train them. We also recently launched an online opportunity for kids to get engaged in learning how to create their own storytelling. It's our Youth Media Lab. So there are some interesting opportunities.
All right. And Tom, we're just about out of time, so I'm going to give you the last word here to talk about the Youth Documentary Academy.
We started a training academy for young people from kind of underrepresented backgrounds in Colorado. And so we work predominantly with women girls and kids of color. And we bring filmmakers out from the Bay Area, and they get to kind of bring their own lived experiences into the process and learn how to make a film to tell their own stories. And love
Great.
That work, too.
So. Great. So hopefully we'll have more films to look forward to from future generations being trained today. So unfortunately, that's all the time we have tonight. But that's City Visions for this evening. Our guests were Rachel Rosen, Director of Programming at SF Film. Thank you for being here, Rachel.
Thanks for having me.
And documentary filmmaker Tom Shepard.
Thank you.
And Amanda Mortimer.
Thank you so much.
Thank you all. And for more information on the film festival, you can go to SF Film, to the website, and get your tickets now for some of the programming coming up. Thanks to all of you for joining us. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Jennifer Ruick and Ann Harper. Join us next time on City Visions on Monday night next week when we discuss the college admissions scandal and what can be done to make college more affordable for more people. This is Ethan Elkind. Thanks so much for listening. Good night, and have a great rest of your week.